This week's reading is taken from Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 33. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They sent their disciples to him with the Herodians. "Teacher," they said, "we know that you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us this, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." They brought him a denarius. And he asked them, "Whose portrait is this? And whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they said. Then he said to them, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." When they heard this, they were amazed. So they left him and went away. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. "Teacher," they said, "Moses told us that if a man dies without having any children, his brother must marry his wife and have children for him. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and the third brother, right on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will be of the seven, since all of them were married to her?" Jesus replied, "You are in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry or be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching.
We're going to be looking at that passage in a bit more detail now. Let me pray for us and then get the PowerPoint up and then we'll get going. Father, please speak to us today. We need your life-giving word so that we might live in this world as people without fear, people with a sure and certain hope, people with a clear direction. Amen. So let me just pick up the PowerPoint. There we go. So we're looking at the wisdom of Jesus today. He's in a situation where he's being trapped. People are trying to do what Jeremy Paxman would do. He asks a question which just leaves them with no good options. And as Jesus answers them, he not only evades the trap, but he also does something deeper. He points people to deep realities about what we're meant to be like as humans, what's going on in our hearts, and what our hope is as physical beings, people who are not merely minds, but also bodies. So see the wisdom of Christ today and see it not just as a good example of, you know, here's somebody who's good at answering questions, but here is the wisdom of God, divine wisdom, so that we will live well in God's world, the world that he's made, the world that he will judge. So firstly, we're going to see the wisdom of Christ calling us to live fully for God in verses 15 to 22. We're told that this is a deliberate plan to trap Jesus. Verse 15, then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. They've crafted a question. Let me just make this bigger. They've crafted a question they think will trip Jesus up, whichever way he answers it. That's why they send the disciples along with the Herodians. So the Pharisees are the religious zealots, the people who are trying to say we must be totally loyal to God and therefore we hate the Roman occupiers. The Herodians are the party of Herod the king. They are the collaborators with the Romans. the ones who work with the Romans to keep the Jewish people under control. And so they come together as a team because one or other of them is going to get offended. And they make it sound like they're being respectful. Teacher, they said, we know that you're a man of integrity and teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. You know, get ready for your honesty to get you into trouble, Jesus. And then they ask the question, comes in verse 17. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not? So here's the setup. Jesus says no. Well, the Herodians, who are the Roman collaborators, will arrest Jesus and put him on trial and get him executed as a rebel against Roman rule. The price for their power, given power by the Romans, is that they will act as the middlemen and keep peace, keep the Jewish population under control. So Jesus says no to this question. He is in trouble. He's going to be arrested and executed as a rebel. But if Jesus says yes to paying this hated tax to the Romans, he seems to be failing to honor God. It's not just that taxes are unpleasant, but the God of Israel forbids any sorts of idolatry. And these coins that you pay your tax in, the Roman have not only the image of the Roman emperor, but claim him to be a son of the divine Augustus. It's a blasphemous claim. And it describes him as the high priest, which for the Jews is horrendous. There is one high priest, and that's the high priest in the Jerusalem temple. But the Roman emperor claims to be Pontifex Maximus. So if Jesus says yes to paying this tax, it's not only that he's on the side of the oppressive colonial power, he is compromising religiously. And the Pharisees and the crowds will be against him. And of course, if the crowds are against him, then it will be easy for the leadership to take him out. Back in Matthew 21 and verse 46, the religious leaders looked for a way to arrest him, but they were afraid of the crowd because the people held that he was a prophet. So if the crowds reject Jesus, he's in trouble. The leaders stand by to swoop in and arrest him. Faced with this question, Jesus answers with confidence and wisdom. He not only avoids the trap, but actually what he does is he holds up a mirror to his opponents to expose what's going on in their hearts. Verse 18, Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose image is this? And whose inscription?" So Jesus replies to the question. And already something very important is revealed. The Pharisees and the Herodians have Roman money with the blasphemous inscription, and Jesus does not. If anyone's complicit with Roman occupation and idolatry, it's not Jesus. If anyone loves to hold on to money and has it in their pockets, it's not Jesus. But in response to Jesus' question, they're forced to admit that the money they use bears Caesar's image. There's a picture on the PowerPoint here of the coin that's in the Fitzwilliam Museum. I think that's one of Claudius or Claudius. In Jesus' time, it would have been the Emperor Tiberius. But the point is that as they use this sort of coin, they were not independent of Caesar. They benefit from Caesar's currency in their trading and saving. So Jesus tells them, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God. So they should give to Caesar what Caesar's. This money came from Caesar. It symbolizes his rule for good and for ill. If they benefit from his law keeping and roads and peace and currency, then they should pay his taxes, even if he's also at times unjust and a worshipper of idols. So far, Jesus has avoided being arrested as a rebel against Rome. But now, is he about to be rejected by the devout crowds as someone who's okay with idol worship rather than being devoted to the true God? No. Give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And here is where Jesus is not only evading the trap, but he's showing divine wisdom. He's holding up a mirror to our hearts. It's absolutely clear. God comes first for Jesus. And we should give back to him what belongs to God. What belongs to God? Everything. And what, like the coins bearing Caesar's image, bears God's image? You and I. Human beings, each one of us made in the image of God, bearing God's image. And so our whole lives should be offered to God, serving in the way he calls us to. Jesus isn't compromising with polytheism when he says pay taxes to the pagan emperor Caesar. He's calling everyone to give everything to God, to love Yahweh your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. God comes first and deserves everything. And within that serving God, then also we are to give to those in positions of authority their honor and taxes, provided they don't ask us to go against God. But Jesus' call is actually much bigger than should we pay taxes. It's live fully for God, because we are made by God and stamped with his image. We cannot escape this responsibility and calling. The image is indelibly marked on each human being. And we all fall short of this calling. None of us lives the perfect life of love and purity God deserves. And so we all need to receive the perfect image of God, Jesus Christ, who Colossians 1 describes as the image of the invisible God. We need to receive Jesus as God of our lives and welcome his forgiveness for falling short. We need to receive his Spirit, which is transforming us back to the true likeness of God. You see the wisdom of Christ today, which not only avoids the pitfalls of the question about tax, but calls each person to live fully for God. And as Jesus calls for that, it exposes our sinful failure and selfish motives. It exposes how often we ask questions which are really about evading Jesus' call on our life and the calling that we have as creatures made by God to live fully for him. And because we've fallen short, we need to call out to Jesus, the one who lives the perfect life for us, pays the penalty for falling short for us, and then share his overcoming resurrection life with us. If we are to live fully for God now, it's going to involve trusting Jesus and letting him transform us. The Pharisees and Herodians are amazed. They leave him. But then up step his next question is, verse 23. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. One of the things we can easily forget about life in Israel 2,000 years ago is that not everyone was the same. Just as there are all sorts of different religions and even within Christianity, different churches today, so there were different sorts of Jewish belief and practice back then. The Pharisees have been active throughout Matthew's gospel. They're a kind of a lay movement, scattered around, encouraging people to go back to the Torah and to keep the law. They're also nationalists. They're pro-Israel as a separate nation. Whereas the Sadducees are a temple movement or party. And one of their distinctives seems to be that they focus on the law of Moses and ignore the writings of the prophets, which speak more clearly about the physical resurrection when God's kingdom is complete. So these Sadducees have constructed a question which they think will expose the absurdity of believing in bodily resurrection. It's an argument, no doubt, they've used against the Pharisees as well, because the Pharisees also believe, like Jesus, in physical resurrection. But here's the question the Sadducees ask. Verse 24. Teacher, they said, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for him. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first one married and died, and since he had no children, he left his wife to his brother. The same thing happened to the second and third brother, right up on down to the seventh. Finally, the woman died. Now then, at the resurrection, whose wife will she be of the seven, since all of them were married to her? So you can see the argument easily enough. If people are raised up bodily, then what happens to those who are widowed and then remarried? If they're all there with their renewed bodies, are they still connected in marriage in a complicated way? Being married to all seven brothers would be against the law of Moses. Or do you lose your spouse in eternity if you die first and your spouse remarries? Doesn't this problem of what happens about marriage in the resurrection life expose that actually this resurrection thing, this bodies for eternity thing, is nonsense? It's a version of the argument reductio ad absurdum. You show the folly of a position, the falseness of a position, by showing the foolish conclusions it leads to. But again, Jesus is wise in answering them. And in doing so, he speaks of the hope we can have of life beyond death, life to the full. Verse 29, Jesus replied, "You are in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven." So Jesus highlights the Sadducees' lack of belief and knowledge. they forget that God's made everything from nothing and gave life to all living things. And they've not paid enough attention to the scriptures. But what Jesus then says seems to bring a new insight that he brings as the God who has become man, the Son come down to earth, because it's not entirely clear to me where he'd get this from in the Old Testament. Jesus declares, as the one who knows, at the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Life in the world to come is going to be different. And one of the key differences is that we won't be married, which of course means that the problem the Sadducees raise about the woman and these brothers won't be a problem. She won't be married to any of them. Something you might be thinking, I like being married. I don't want to lose that. That's understandable if your marriage is happy. I think there are two things going on that help us to look forward to this resurrection life without marriage, that help us to know that Jesus is assuring us a full life with God, not a grey life of loss. Firstly, all the humans in God's new creation will corporately be married to Jesus Christ. The intimacy and joy found in a good earthly marriage is a picture of a better and higher intimacy and joy that we will have in relationship with God. There will be life there to the full, a knowing and being known that is secure and joyful forever, a relationship that truly satisfies. So an ultimate marriage is coming, which will put all earthly marriages in the shade, make them all insignificant in comparison. And then even our relationships with other human beings will be raised up to a far higher level of love and honesty and true connection than we achieve on earth. I take it that we will know our earthly spouse better and love them more truly in the resurrection life than we do now. Even at that point, we're no longer married to them. We no longer have that exclusive relationship. We will actually know and love them and many other people better than the best relationship on earth now. Jesus is assuring us of a higher and fuller life with God, one in which we'll be fully satisfied. He finishes by making a very compressed argument based on God appearing to Moses at the burning bush. But about the resurrection of the dead, verse 31, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. This is in the law of Moses. So if the Sadducees aren't accepting the prophets, they have to accept this. It's like Jesus goes onto their ground and says, look, even if I accept your wrong view that only the first five books of the Bible are scripture, I can still prove my case. And he goes to the burning bush incident where God speaks to Moses and says, not I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob hundreds of years before, but I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Jesus draws the implication that they are still alive with God rather than dead and gone. It's a very compressed argument. I think it's quite hard for us in our setting to feel the force of this argument. It seems like not the obvious place to go. But in verse 34, we learn that Jesus was viewed as having silenced the Sadducees with his argument. So it was viewed as effective in that day. So once again, we've seen Jesus' wisdom. He's able to take a tripwire question and avoid the trap while teaching profound lessons. Here he shows us what we need to hear in these disturbed times. That God is the God of the living, that death does not remove us from God's grasp, and that resurrection life, when it comes, is life to the full, life that exceeds the best that earthly life has to offer.